The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For Democrats, it's to shift the public's perception about how problematic what came out in the report is. I think for Republicans, it's to try to shift perceptions towards this idea that, you know, this isn't actually that big of a deal, that sort of thing. And so I think it also reflects to some degree people's beliefs about how successful members will be at coordinating on a single message. You know, I think a focus on, say, just yes or no questions, like Comey suggested in his Lawfare piece, if that's your strategy, it's like a little bit easier to get members to just stick to the script. If you tell them, you know, everyone's just going to ask yes or no questions. And I think if you're concerned about the degree to which Mueller is pretty unlikely to go outside the bounds of the report, focusing on yes or no questions might be a safer bet. But I think that's also less likely to produce the kind of dramatic moments that some people think might be necessary to really reshape the narrative. And so I think that there are just different ways, even if you share the goal of getting a change in the public's perceptions of the Mueller report, there are just different ways to think about how you might do that.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 23rd, 2019. Finally, this week, former FBI Director Robert Swan Mueller III will testify before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees about the findings from his work as special counsel investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 election, as well as any coordination or links between the Russian government and individuals associated with the Trump campaign. To preview this testimony, we are bringing in Molly Reynolds, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Margaret Taylor, senior editor at Lawfare and fellow at Brookings, and Lawfare's editor-in-chief and Brookings senior fellow, Benjamin Wittes. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 437, Mueller's Testimony, a Preview.
Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here with a little scheduling announcement regarding what's going to be an interesting week ahead on the podcast. So this week, as you know, is Mueller week, and we have a variety of offerings that we're going to do in connection with that. So today's podcast, which if you're hearing this, you've already downloaded, is a kind of preview of the testimony. At the time of the testimony, we will very likely do one of our special edition emergency podcasts. That'll be on Wednesday afternoon, evening. Then Thursday, we will put together our No Bull podcast of just questions and answers from the entire testimony. And then, of course, on Friday, we will have the second episode of our special series, The Report. So we've got a lot of content coming, and I just thought this might help you map out your time on your schedule for Lawfare podcasts this coming week.
Let's start with the atmospherics going into Mueller's testimony. Ben, how do things look to you from the perspective of how congressional leaders, Mueller, and the president are setting the stage for this?
Yeah, so it's good to break it up that way because the atmospherics are, I think, pretty different depending on who you are. From Congress's point of view, they've invested an enormous amount in this day, and so the question, of course, is can they get Bob Mueller to deliver anything that justifies the amount of energy that they've put into and the amount of hopes and investment that they've made in the spectacle of Bob Mueller testifying before a congressional committee. And so I think the initial atmospherics from a congressional point of view are there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of expectation, and there's also a lot of fear that the nature of the day is not going to deliver the kind of punch that those hopes and fears generate. From Mueller's point of view, you know, this is the day that he held an entire press conference to try to prevent from ever happening. And, you know, Mueller has made very clear that he wrote a report and he expects people to read the report. And that's that report is what he has to say. And he's not looking for a deeper spectacle level of engagement with the public or with Congress. And so I think his interest is in trying to keep things as minimally satisfying as humanly possible from a from an atmospheric kind of spectacle public attention level. And then there's the White House, which is, you know, I think principally interested in diminishing and disparaging the investigation and the nature of any substantive discussion that may happen. You know, whether this stuff is terrible for the president or good for the president in a negative reflecting kind of way, you know, criticize me and I will use it to my advantage, you know, by talking about the conspiracy against me and the witch hunt and all of that stuff, is, I think, a kind of open political question. But it's fair to say that we pretty well know what the president is expecting from this, which is a foil from which to tweet and say angry things about the evil people who tried to stage a coup against him.
Sure. Ben, are you surprised that Rudy Giuliani and the usual suspects have not been more vocal in the last few days trying to build up a narrative in front of this testimony?
You know, I guess yes, in the sense that if you had asked me 3 weeks ago what would Rudy Giuliani be doing in the run-up to Mueller's testimony, I would have suggested he'd be on every Sunday talk show and the president would be, you know, tweeting aggressively. And so I suppose in that sense it's a little bit surprising. On the other hand, you know, we sometimes give the president's camp credit for a level of PR and tactical sophistication that is actually not real. And, you know, they're highly impulsive and they just kind of do what they do at the moment that they do it. And we retroactively impute a kind of brilliance or sophistication or savvy to it when really it's a bunch of people flailing and sort of shooting from the hip. And so I guess I would say, yes, I am surprised, but I probably shouldn't be.
Sure. Let's go back to Congress for a few minutes. Molly, what insight do we have on the evolving approach to this day of testimony?
So as far as we know, the plan is for Mueller to appear for 3 hours in front of the House Judiciary Committee, followed by 2 hours in front of the House Intelligence Committee in open session. Reporting suggests that the two committees will generally take a division of labor where Judiciary covers what's in Volume 2 of the Mueller report, Intelligence covers what's in Volume 1.
You say generally, but obviously members can do whatever they want, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we can talk more about sort of that coordination challenge that, frankly, both parties face. But like I said, all reporting sort of suggests that the focus of the Judiciary hearing will be on Volume 2 and the focus of the Intel hearing will be on Volume 1. Reporting also suggests that at least among the Judiciary Democrats, there's reportedly going to be a focus on five episodes that were members think there could have been chargeable offenses related to obstruction of justice. Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, I think reporting has indicated, are more likely to focus on things in the report that can be portrayed as favorable to President Trump and on this message of this having been an unfair investigation up to the president. I think in both cases, with both parties, particularly on judiciary, there's going to be a little bit of a tension between the degree to which members kind of stay behind their party strategy versus go off a little bit on their own. There's some reporting from CNN, for example, where Representative Steve Cohen of Tennessee is quoted as saying, quote, there will be a question or two that will be Steve Cohen and not the team. There's some reporting in the New York Times that expresses similar indications about House Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. So I think that that will be kind of one big storyline. The other thing that I'll note that the New York Times has reported is that we're relatively unlikely, at least according to their plans on the Judiciary Committee, for the Republicans to engage in the kind of procedural hijinks that we've seen during a couple other high-profile hearings, right, where they've had votes to sort of delay the progress of the hearing. I think a lot of that has to do with the time limit, that the Republicans see some value in the hearing potentially for their side, and that knowing that they have this time limit, that they don't necessarily want to use some of their time holding votes on motions to adjourn and that sort of thing.
And Margaret, weigh in on this. What are you seeing?
So I do want to weigh in on that. First, I just want to make a point that I just got to get off my chest. You know, a lot of the press and others have been sort of diving right into sort of, you know, what is the advantage going to be to Democrats? Is the advantage going to be to Republicans on this hearing? I just want to make the point that, in my opinion, the House Democrats had to do this. They had to call Mueller up. Like, just from a good governance standpoint, he had to come up and testify based on what's in this report. So there really was no, you know, option to not bring him up. And I think it was the right thing to do. So I just want to say that. Molly's exactly right. And I'm sort of reading the situation the same way that she is. You know, one question I have is that the Judiciary Committee hearing is first. It's in the morning. And then the Intelligence Committee hearing is in the afternoon. And it seems if what you're trying to do here is...
Seems backwards, doesn't it?
Yeah, if it's build a narrative for the American people to understand what happened, it seems a little bit strange to me to start with the obstruction of justice piece and then move to the, you know, Russian sort of attack on the election piece. But, you know, we'll see how that plays out. There's probably ways to sort of elide that, a little bit of the strangeness of that from a narrative perspective. I do wonder how it's going to work out. And just to, you know, piggyback on what Molly said, you know, Republicans, I think, are less structured than the Democrats in sort of how they're approaching this, it would seem, and less coordinated. And I think what they'll do is sort of adapt to whatever unfolds in these hearings. So, and I've been actually a little bit surprised at what some Republicans have been saying publicly about what they want to get out of this, just sort of saying the quiet part out loud. So, for example, Representative Matt Gaetz pledged, this is in the New York Times, pledged to appoint a discussion of bias in the investigation and said that his goal for the hearing was, quote, we are going to reelect the president, unquote, which is just not something you really hear in the context of congressional hearings very often. So I thought that was very interesting. And then the last point I'll make is that, you know, unlike a lot of hearings, so much of this depends on how Mueller responds, how he answers these questions. I think it's just so hard to really predict how this is going to go because we don't know with really any specificity how Mueller's really going to respond to these questions.
You're assuming there's some process of adaptation here, some evolution that can happen during the hearing, but most members, if they have their talking points, they're not going to go off script because Mueller gives a slightly longer or shorter answer than they expected. Or will they? Perhaps that's something that they will do on the fly.
I think it's possible because, you know, if the tone and tenor of a hearing is sort of going badly, for example, for someone like Representative Gaetz, then he will adapt his approach to make it go better for him. And, you know, we see this in hearings all the time. Members try to sort of change the tack and tenor of a hearing. I mean, we saw that with Senator Lindsey Graham in the Kavanaugh hearings. You know, he sort of single-handedly turned that hearing sort of around and took it in a different direction because right. He saw it was going
yeah,
badly.
I think that's the example that came to mind for me, too, when you asked the question, David, is that that's an example where, you know, Republicans had one strategy going into that hearing that actually included questioning by and expert counsel and not by senators themselves. And I think we may talk about kind of that question in relation to Mueller in a little bit. And then as the hearing was unfolding and different things were happening, they really changed course mid-hearing. So, you know, there are some important differences between that and the Mueller hearing. We're talking about the House, not the Senate. We're talking about a hearing with a time limit, that kind of thing. But it, I think Margaret's absolutely right to mention that, you know, sometimes we see this happen in hearings and we could in this one as well.
Let me take a half step back before we go forward, because there was the bigger issue of this testimony, which was, when is it going to be? We all thought it was going to be last week, and then all of a sudden we got thrown a curve. So, Molly, why was this so hard to schedule?
Sure. So the notion that a high-profile witness and a House or Senate committee engage in negotiations about the terms of the witness's appearance, that's nothing new. We see things like that happen all the time. I think the biggest sticking point in the case of this particular hearing is this idea that the committees were going to agree to a time limit for the overall hearing. And the initial reporting suggested that both committees, both Judiciary and Intelligence, were going to have Mueller appear for only 2 hours each. On the Judiciary Committee, what that would have meant is that all of the members, particularly all of the members on the Democratic side, because there are more Democrats on the committee than there are Republicans because they're in the majority, not all of the members would have been able to ask Mueller questions in the two-hour time limit. Under both the rules of the full House and the Judiciary Committee rules, the way that hearings generally proceed is that each member who wants to ask questions of a witness has 5 minutes to do so. And just by, if we were to sort of do the math, multiply the number of members by 5 minutes to account for the amount of time that Mueller would spend answering the questions, that would take longer than 2 hours. And so that proved to be that sort of change from how Congress usually operates. And, you know, we think about other examples of very high-profile witnesses on Capitol Hill. You know, we associate those sorts of things with hours and hours of testimony, Hillary right. Clinton before the Benghazi committee, that sort of thing. And so Congress isn't an institution that sort of changes direction well. And so the idea of trying to adapt and change the way that Congress, again, particularly the Judiciary Committee, was going to approach this hearing proved to be sticky. And we can discuss whether sort of individual members of the House Judiciary Committee were right or wrong to insist on their questioning time. But all the reporting suggests that kind of that's where we were about 2 weeks ago. And then everyone kind of took a step back, tried to figure out how can we accommodate all the interests at play here. And then where we ended up is what we are reportedly going to get on Wednesday.
I have a feeling we will all be analyzing after the testimony whether said members of the Judiciary Committee needed that time for what they used it for.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, much of what people who watch Congress do is spent sort of looking back at what they've done and asking whether it was worth it. And so, but I do think that that's kind of, that's the overall picture that we're looking at here, which is that we have a committee in Congress that usually operates one way, was trying to figure out a way to operate in a different way than it usually does. And that can be challenging for members of Congress.
Ben, you published on Lawfare back on July 8th, the article, "If I Had 5 Minutes to Question Robert Mueller," which I always hear in song rather than in the spoken word. But
I just to be clear, I specifically wrote it with kind of Fiddler in the Roof in mind. You know,
that's
if I
tune.
Had 5 minutes with Mueller,
I think,
yeah, absolutely.
I think we should do all Lawfare podcasts in song from now on with that as inspiration. You laid out an approach that if you were a member that you would use to get the best out of Mueller's testimony without getting the 90% of bad things that we have talked about anticipating here. Walk us briefly through your concept.
Well, so I guess to understand the concept, you have to first understand the challenge, right? Which is each member only has 5 minutes to ask questions with a person who does not want to be there. And that matters because when a witness wants to be there, they're kind of working with you.
Right.
And they'll be pretty forgiving of badly formulated questions. But when a witness doesn't want to be there, you know, any question that you ask that isn't precisely formulated they're going to use the imprecision to avoid giving you any kind of a satisfying answer.
You can almost hear Mueller just saying no and looking back at the congressman instead of going off on a conversation, just rejecting the premise of a question or saying, no, I'm not going to do that.
Right. Or even saying, I'm not sure I understand the question. Can you reformulate it? Right. And, you know, in 5 minutes, you don't have a lot of time to bloviate and to express imprecision in questions that then get used to not address the questions. And by the way, Mueller has also said very clearly that he doesn't mean to go beyond the four corners of the report. He said the report is my testimony, and if made to testify publicly, I would not say more than is already in it. So how do you deal with a witness who doesn't want to be there, who's said he's not going to say more than he has already said in the report, and who you only have 5 minutes at a time with? And so the as I thought about that, I thought, well, okay, here are a few principles that members can use to address that challenge. So the first is ask yes or no questions, right? If you ask him to explain something, first of all, you give him the chance to take the conversation in a direction that you might not want it to go.
Right.
You should simply ask him yes or no questions. Number two, those questions should all be questions that are clearly within the four corners of the report. So in other words, you're asking him to confirm things that he has in fact already said, which will make it much more difficult for him to say, I don't want to go beyond what's in the report. We didn't address that question. It would be inappropriate of me to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, you should ask a sequence of these questions, yes or no questions within the four corners of the report that you know the answer to, that lead up to one and only one major point that you want to bring out.
Is that because there's not enough time to develop multiple points?
Yes. And also because you have colleagues. And so you should think about the sequence of people who can ask sequences of questions that will develop multiple points. But you, the individual member of Congress, should use your 5 minutes to develop one point. And so the example that I used in my piece was how to develop the idea that, which I think is clearly in the report, but it would be great to have Mueller saying publicly himself in his own voice that they found substantial evidence that the president had obstructed justice and left the initial question of whether that constitutes an impeachable offense to Congress and the ultimate question of whether the president should be prosecuted to future prosecutors after he had left office. And so I mapped out a set of possible questions designed to elucidate that point.
Do members have the discipline to do this, to stick to one main point, to have Mueller answer yes or no questions, to have, in a sense, to restrain themselves from pontificating? I'll turn to you, Margaret, because as part of that, I hope you walk through your argument, which you wrote up for Lawfare recently, on why congressional leaders should alter the hearing format for this testimony.
So, you know, I think it is possible for members to exercise some measure of discipline when the stakes are high enough. My idea is actually less related to discipline. It's more related to really the structure and the format. And personally, I think my proposal is very simple and modest. You know, as Molly described, each member has 5 minutes. And traditionally in these committees, the way that's done is the chairman takes his or her 5 minutes, then turns to the ranking member who gets their 5 minutes, and then it goes back and forth from Democrat to Republican, back and forth until everyone's done. And that usually works. For most hearings, you know, it works just fine, and the types of questions that are being asked aren't, you know, so different if you're a Democrat or Republican. This hearing's not going to be that way. This hearing is highly you know, politicized along partisan lines. And, you know, my proposal is, you know, give each side the chance to develop its narrative. So, for example, the chairman could call on all the Democrats serially first, sort of in one block. Give the Democrats a chance to develop the narrative that they are looking to get out of this hearing from Bob Mueller. Then turn to all the Republicans and, you know, ask, you know, them to use their 5 minutes in a serial way. It's just something that would seem to make sense. I mean, I think we see in a lot of these congressional hearings, you get a bit of whiplash watching it, and it's stilted and a little bit bizarre, and it just can seem just like it doesn't make sense.
The idea, in theory, is the principle of fairness, right? That you don't want to give one side the first hour of the hearing because some people might tune in at the beginning and then go off and do something else. On the other hand, it would give both sides the opportunity to develop their narrative. So you think there'd be some interest on this from both the Republican side and the Democrat side of the aisle.
You'd think. I do think, though, as Molly said, you know, Congress is a body that hews to tradition and, you know, only changes under very, very extreme circumstances. So we probably won't see it happen. But I do hope that it can be, you know, an idea that's considered for the future, at least.
Yeah. And I think that in sort of today's Congress, both sides are so attuned to the idea that any change, whatever it is that we're talking about, is really an effort by the other side to gain some sort of partisan upper hand. I think that's also part of just what makes it difficult for Congress to get outside of its usual box. The idea that both sides are thinking, oh, what sort of multidimensional chess is the other side playing to get an advantage? And I think that that's part of why, to Margaret's point, that even if there are arguments as to why a different format might actually be good for both parties, that both parties are somewhat likely to resist those kinds of changes.
It's safer just to stick with what is known.
Exactly.
Ben, bouncing back to your approach to questioning Robert Mueller, we also published on Lawfare Jim Comey on Friday, refining these questions a bit. I was wondering if you could give your reactions to his line of questioning, which is slightly different than what you did.
Yeah, so Jim's, first of all, a much better trial lawyer and prosecutor than I am. Him having actually been both an AUSA and a U.S. attorney, and me never having actually had to handle a witness. So I was amused that Comey, first of all, you know, kind of took my model and tried to refine it. And secondly, I have to say he did a better job than I did. I think his line of questioning it's less wordy than mine, and really refines the idea in an interesting way. And what he did is he takes only the executive summaries from both Volume 1 and Volume 2 of the report and asks very simple questions that are drawn directly from the executive summaries. So you can point to the specific lines
right
in the report where you're asking Bob Mueller to confirm, did you find X, Y, and Z? And they're all very, very short. And so I think, you know, if I were a member of Congress, I would probably lean toward Comey's style of questions over mine, although I do think that the piece that I wrote is an interesting example of how to bring out some higher level points, some sort of meta points about the report using only text and questions drawn directly from it.
One similarity between your questions and Jim Comey's questions are that they are closed questions. They are primarily yes or no questions. Let me run by you what the two men leading the hearings on Wednesday said this weekend that may indicate a different direction they're going. On Fox News Sunday, Jerry Nadler of the Judiciary Committee said in part that the members have to let Mueller present facts to the American people. And then Adam Schiff of the Intelligence Committee said on CBS Face the Nation, who better to bring them, referring back to what he called a damning set of facts, who better to bring them to life than the man who did the investigation himself? That really sounds like they want Mueller to speak those money quotes instead of simply responding yes or no to a member reading those quotes. How do you react to those statements?
Well, so look, I think if what they mean by bring to life is that they want Bob Mueller to explicate and tell the story in his own words in a kind of, you know, narrative format, like they're going to be super disappointed. I'm not
his strong suit.
It's also not like he has said directly, I don't want to do that. And I see no reason not to take Bob Mueller at his word about that. When you say not his strong suit, you're also flagging an important point, which is don't confuse Bob Mueller with Jim Comey. Jim Comey is charismatic and he is an amazingly good storyteller, and he's a master of the form of congressional testimony, whether it's in telling the Stellar Wind story or in telling the story of his own interactions with the president. He is an electrifying presence, whether you admire him or hate him. You can't really take your eyes off him when he's testifying. Bob Mueller is not that. You can't think of the famous Bob Mueller testimony before Congress, and there's a reason for that. It's not that he hasn't testified a lot of times. And so, you know, you're dealing with somebody who doesn't want to be there and who's not a particular master of that form of communication, even when he does want to be there. And so I think the idea that you're going to get him to do what you want him to do rather than what he wants to do is probably fanciful. If you want him to tell the story that's in the report, the way you're going to have to do that is by getting him to read the report. And I think there may be a place for, you know, if you really want to highlight what he found on a particular page, I think you can say to him, Mr. Mueller, on page, you know, 420, mm-hmm. paragraph 3, can you read your finding there for us? Like that, I suspect you'll be able to do. But the explication of the document, I think, is probably something that you're going to have to bring out through more precise questioning rather than just kind of opening the floor to him to deliver the goods for you.
Molly, what do you read into what Nadler and Schiff are saying here?
So I think this question of how members should use their time and what kinds of things they should ask Mueller really just reflect different beliefs that people have about how this hearing might shift the public's perceptions of the Mueller report. I think for both sides of the aisle, that's kind of where the push is. You know, for Democrats, it's to shift the public's perception about, you know, how problematic what came out in the report is. I think for Republicans, it's to try to shift perceptions towards this idea that, you know, this isn't actually that big of a deal, that sort of thing. And so I think it also reflects to some degree people's beliefs about how successful members will be at coordinating on a single message. You know, I think a focus on, say, just yes or no questions, like Comey suggested in his Lawfare piece, if that's your strategy, it's like a little bit easier to get members to just stick to the script. If you tell them, you know, everyone's just going to ask yes or no questions. And I think if you're concerned about the degree to which Mueller is pretty unlikely to go outside the bounds of the report, focusing on yes or no questions might be a safer bet. But I think that's also less likely to produce the kind of dramatic moments that some people think might be necessary to really reshape the narrative. And so I think that there are just different ways, even if you share the goal of getting a change in the public's perceptions of the Mueller report, there are just different ways to think about how you might do that.
Right. And let's be fair here. The idea of the yes or no questions being a good strategy didn't come from nowhere. Mueller himself has said, I'm going to stick to the four corners of this report. If I'm called to testify, which I don't want to do, I'm not going to go beyond the report. So there's a reason behind that. Let's add to this, Margaret. Do you get the sense members are actually taking Mueller and his personality, his strengths, his weaknesses, his skills into account?
It seems like they're trying to. Reportedly, there's tons of preparation going on ahead of this hearing. I think there's a lot of pressure, particularly on Democrats, but Republicans also, to sort of get it right, get out of it what they want to get out of it. There's some reporting on like mock hearings where a staffer is assigned to play the part of Bob Mueller. So it really does seem like they're trying. But really, Dave, this is a question for you. I mean, you briefed Mueller every day for a year back when he was the FBI director. So how's he likely to treat this in your view?
Well, I'll build on what Ben just said about him sticking to the four corners of the report, that Mueller has made clear, I don't want to do this. I'm not going to do this. Don't make me do this. And then he's doing this. I think part of that is based on his interpretation of the mission, having worked with him pretty closely for a year. I got to see that he had a task and he stuck to it. And he was tasked by the Deputy Attorney General to investigate the links and coordination between the Russian government and the individuals associated with the campaign and give his report to the Attorney General, or in this case, the Acting Attorney General, for the purposes of that investigation. Mueller did that job. He delivered his findings as directed, not to Congress, not to the American people, not on Twitter, but via his chain of command. Under the regulations, that's what he was supposed to do. So I'm not surprised that he didn't want to testify. Him putting out there the idea that he did not want to testify, of course, like you said, Margaret, makes the Democrats want to call him to testify, to say, okay, let's dig in just a little bit deeper and see what's going on. Also, earlier, we talked about Mueller's strong suit. Three reactions to that. First, I expect him to wear a very strong suit, probably dark, his traditional white shirt, very plain tie. He's going to look like the Bob Mueller we've always seen. But more seriously, secondly, my experience with him suggests that he is not going to play along with shenanigans here. He's not going to get into a sparring match with members of Congress who decide to try to rile him up. I can imagine him giving a very short, direct answer to any question seeking to get him to talk about exactly how many angry Democrats were there on your staff, Mr. Mueller. I can see him giving a short, curt answer. And then when somebody asks the same question, I can see that member getting the same death stare I got when I would repeat something in a briefing and he knew that he had already said the answer to that question. And then finally, I don't see him looking for any opportunity to get in subtle hints. People will be trying to read this, like people used to look at pictures of the Politburo in Moscow when they appeared for annual parades to see who's standing next to whom and what does that tell us about the relationships. I don't see Mueller trying to drop hints here, trying to leave us crumbs that we can chase to find what exactly happened, that he's just wink, wink, not willing to tell us. So to me, I think you're going to get a very straightforward Mueller. We've seen him in testimony before. He answers questions, yes. He gives information, yes. But he does not go beyond what he is required to do in most cases. Ben, there's the line in the Mueller report that you and others have keyed in on, in which Mueller writes that although the events we investigated involved discrete acts, in his words, it is important to view the president's pattern of conduct as a whole. That is hard to do with members drilling down on specific page numbers and each of the acts involving Michael Flynn, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, etc. How is it they are going to get out of this the pattern of the president's conduct as a whole with hours of testimony drilling down on individual matters?
Well, you would like to think the answer to that is by designing those sequences of questions very well and in conversational interaction with one another, so that you have a series of discrete lines of question that each bring out a point that then we can, over time, creates a larger picture. That would be the ideal. Reminder that we are dealing with members of Congress here who will always elevate their own presence over some larger aggregate portrait that they can create together. This is, Congress is a giant set of collective action problems, and this is an example of that. So the answer in practice may be you can't, which brings us back to the limitations of this format as a way of illuminating the Mueller report.
Where does this put us all in terms of particularly the overall impeachment debate? Molly, let me turn to you. Nadler also said on Fox News Sunday that the Mueller report provides very substantial evidence that Trump is, in Nadler's words, guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, putting out there formally on the record that he thinks the president has met one of the constitutional conditions for impeachment by the House and conviction by the Senate. especially given the House vote last week on Representative Al Green's impeachment proposal. What does this all mean?
Sure. So I think when we think about impeachment and impeachment proceedings, first of all, it's worth taking a step back. And Margaret and I have actually written about this a little bit together, that the idea, sort of what is an impeachment proceeding and what sort of qualifies as an impeachment proceeding and what difference does it make if you call something an impeachment proceeding, is a less well-defined concept than I think sometimes we talk about. And so the idea that all of this information gathering, the appearance by Mueller, everything that the Judiciary Committee has been up to is perhaps or could ultimately be related to impeachment is an important thing to remember. I think kind of where we are in the overall evolution of this. So we, for example, saw last week a procedural vote in the House on a resolution brought up by Al Green, a Democrat of Texas. It's an impeachment resolution. Green did this using a particular procedure called a question of privilege that meant he could do it without kind of the sign-off from the House leadership. It's actually the third time that Green has done this since the beginning of the Trump administration. And each time he's done so, we've seen more Democrats side with him on the procedural vote. Mm-hmm. So when he did it in December of 2017, there were 58 Democrats who voted with him on the procedural vote. There were 66 in January 2018, and we saw 95 last week.
And your point is that's not a vote to impeach. That's merely a vote to say— let's actually refer this to the Judiciary Committee and get working on this as an impeachment inquiry.
So this is actually a very important point. So these votes, these procedural votes on Green's impeachment resolutions aren't just proxy votes. There's mm-hmm. for how you feel about impeachment. There's some of that mm-hmm. in them, but a couple other important points. One is that generally the majority party leadership in the House does not like having their agenda setting power circumvented. So if you are an ally of Pelosi and Hoyer and the other members of the House leadership, you're somewhat likely to be skeptical of this move simply because you don't want to encourage members rank-and-file members to kind of go outside the bounds of the schedule that the leadership is setting. The second thing that we saw specifically on last week's vote is that a couple of members, including Chairman Nadler and Zoe Lofgren, who's the second-ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, voted with Green because they didn't like the particular procedural way in which Democrats were dealing with this resolution. Democrats basically had two options. They could vote to table the resolution, which sort of kills it entirely, or they could have voted to, as you mentioned, refer it to the Judiciary Committee. And both Nadler and Lofgren and a number of other Democrats, including some on the Judiciary Committee, said they would have preferred that as the mechanism. So this is getting pretty far into the sort of congressional weeds, but it's an important point about how when you look at a single vote, some of it is about the substance and some of it is about other things that are going on in the caucus.
Let me follow up on that real quickly, because I recall when I was researching my book on how presidents leave office, I went and found all of the impeachment resolutions that had ever been dropped against a president. And there were quite a few of them, the absolute majority of which went nowhere except to the Judiciary Committee. A lot of them were voted on just in terms of, yes, we'll refer this to the Judiciary Committee, where it died a silent death. Is the worry here perhaps Speaker Pelosi thinking, if we refer this to the Judiciary Committee, where Jerry Nadler has already said he thinks there needs to be a formal inquiry, that he's actually going to pick it up and run with it instead of letting it sit and marinate for a while?
So I think that's entirely possible. It's always hard to kind of get inside the heads of what's happening within the leadership of the caucus. But I think, again, thinking about this particular vote that happened last week, it's just one part of this big overall puzzle with a lot of moving parts about where we've been and where we might be going on the impeachment question. The last thing that I'll say on the Green resolution specifically is that it's telling that they had the vote last week before the Mueller hearing and not this week. Again, because the way that this came to the floor was through this question of privilege, Green has a fair amount of power about when he might decide to call it up on the floor, that we could have imagined that he was going to wait for this week to do it. And I suspect that the sort of decision for him to do it last week was the result of some negotiations between him and the leadership about, you know, you're going to do this, even if we're not necessarily in favor of you doing it.
but in exchange for I don't know what, we would prefer you do it this week. You know, this is about Mueller, but there's a lot of other stuff happening at Capitol Hill this week, too, that requires folks' attention. And so thinking about even when you see a vote that leadership might not like, there may well be behind the scenes negotiations that led it to happen at one time versus another.
Yeah. Margaret, let me kick a lot of this to you to wrap this up. First of all, what do you think of that analysis? Also, you saw the headline Monday morning on CNN that Mueller's big moment is a make or break for the Democrats. Is that a step too far? Does Wednesday's testimony mean that much? What are your closing thoughts on all of this?
So, I mean, I agree with Molly. It's hard to know what's going on behind the scenes. So I totally agree with her. You know, I think it could be a big moment, but maybe not in the way that you and CNN are posing it. You know, do I think this testimony will suddenly swing public opinion widely, you know, in one direction or the other? No, I don't. If you are a person who's supporting Trump at this point in time, I think you will almost certainly continue to support him. If you're someone who is not supporting Trump at this moment in time, I don't think this hearing is going to make you start liking him at this point. It's just, you know, I don't see that type of thing going on. But what I hope comes through on Wednesday, and this might be a little bit Pollyannish of me, but I'm going to say it anyway, is why all of this is a big deal. Why all of this had to be investigated. Why it's important that the investigation wasn't impeded or obstructed in some way. And I feel like that is something that people aren't really saying, and they're not talking about it out loud. And I actually think they need to, because I'm not sure people are really thinking of it. So I'll give you my view, you know, and I hope someone asks Mueller this question, because I actually think he could answer it quite well. You know, why is it important that we guard against foreign influence in our elections and make sure that our representatives and government aren't serving foreign interests? You know, in my view, you know, the heart and soul of a functioning representative democracy is a political process that should constantly be working to reconcile or at least ameliorate divergent views, societal tensions, all in the service of the people, the governed, rather than the service of people who are in power. And when that political process is disrupted by a foreign adversary or other actors pursuing their own aims and not that public aim, it risks becoming captured by those interests and no longer serving the people. And that is what, you know, kind of ruins a democracy and creates instability. And so that's what functioning democracies need to guard against. That's why this is important. And I hope that is what comes through on Wednesday.
We'll end it there. But to our listeners, whether you can watch Mueller's testimony on Wednesday or not, stop by lawfareblog.com or listen to our special podcasts later this week to analyze how this is a big deal, Margaret, and just to help make sense of it all. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Molly Reynolds, Margaret Taylor, and Benjamin Wittes for coming on the show. Please tell someone about the Lawfare Podcast. Share it with your friends, your family, even strangers. Rate it, tweet about it, whatever you can to help us spread the word. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Michaela Fogel helped out, as did Hadley Baker and Vishnu Kanan with the audio engineering. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.